changes in form.
And which changes?
I mean, the changes of the type that, that you see embodied in the University Without Walls and the Union Graduate School. Those changes have been made of that type around the country. The question is, how many of those really have thought through the educational principle on which they should be based, or on the philosophy in which they were developed? In some places they have been, in others they're not. That's one thing that Arthur Chicken worked very hard at Empire State, I think, is to get people to get a philosophical and psychological base for operating that kind of program. I think Forrest Davis has made the same effort working with the University Without Walls, Empire State program, I mean, he's now at Binghamton. Right? Mm-hmm. And a few of the places that I think that have the University Without Walls program that tried to do this. But so many of them have simply grafted those arrangements, I call them, onto the existing outlook. So they retain the credit examination, bookkeeping system of getting people through college.
Mm-hmm. Which makes it more conservative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's the next relationship?
I don't know.
Is that your responsibility, or is that somebody else's responsibility?
You mean, we're talking about nationally?
Well, educationally, what do you think? Do you have a plan of how you think or project or curious about or
well,
where it will go from here?
I think about a good deal in connection with elementary and secondary schools, because I've been on this Vermont Education Advisory Council, and we have to make recommendations on the request for grants under the Title III of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And here you are looking at what are called innovative and exemplary proposals. So you have to think then about, well, is this not only innovative, but is it worthwhile?
Mm-hmm.
Presumably you can have a lot of innovation, but not terribly worthwhile.
Worthwhile in this sense?
That it makes a significant difference in the education of kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't expect it anyway. And you can have a lot of the new arrangements, but wouldn't necessarily result in any better educational opportunities for young people.
So, to me, I guess maybe just because of my background, or what I've read, or because of my association with faith, it seems that education was one of the things that was changing. That has been changing in the last 3 years. And I guess when I asked the question, what comes next, I also thought, well, maybe education is not going to change. Maybe it's going to become integrated with whatever's happening in education. And maybe there are other areas of our lives, of other people's lives, that are going to become more innovative now. In a broader sense, you know.
Well, of course, in a sense, the ways in which people live have changed quite remarkably, and I think will continue to change. I'm not sure that that's all due to the educational institutions, though. There's some changes I really would like to see from the elementary school all the way up through. My observation is, in talking with students, that they tend to be bored. Beginning usually around the high school years or later elementary years. Apparently we have much better teachers by and large in the lower grades than we have farther up. And what I would like to see done would be to reduce the amount of time that kids spend in school and make provision for them to have responsibilities outside the school. Because I think that's where much of the education comes, and you have to adjust it to the age of the kid. But most of the kids that are in Montpelier High School or Spalding High School, for example, have very few real responsibilities outside of school. That's probably true even of Twinfield.
Mm-hmm.
They have some. And consequently, school to them is not related very much, very closely to life. It's not a great challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that you better pull them out of school and have them doing things in the community. If there isn't enough to be done on the private enterprise, let's have them do some public capacity, all kinds of jobs. We don't want the marsh unit, for example, marsh unit kids to do. Those of us who grew up on farms know that at the age of 12, we begin to assume a lot of responsibilities. Remember, part of the boy, it's a gradual process, actually, but by the time you're 12, you have quite a few responsibilities. Well, no reason, no. There is a reason, but it's not as strong as people.
Mm-hmm.
Why we couldn't make that arrangement. And I would follow the same policy through college. I think there's still, I think for a long time, and probably continuously, there'll be some persons who will find it really worthwhile to go to college and stay there and study, make it a truly intellectual experience all the time. But I think for most persons, that will not be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that it would be a good idea for them to be in college as long as they find it really productive, whether that's a semester or a year or 4 years, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Drop out and do something else,
mm-hmm.
but with the provision for coming back in.
Mm-hmm.
And then this ought to go on throughout life, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've got the resources and we could do it.
About 7 or 8 years ago, Dave and I had this idea that children should stop in the school at the age of 12. They have learned every basic school skill that they're ever going to learn. And between the age of 12 and 20, they should not be allowed in school. And that's when they should be doing sort of old-time CCC work. In the community, they should be taking care of roads, they should be building schools, they should be helping mothers with their children, they should be working in the community. And then those who actually wanted to pursue intellectual pursuits should then be able to resume school at roughly the age of 20 or whatever, when they really knew what they had wanted to do after being out there. And then throughout their lives, they could be entering and leaving some kind of an educational, you know, institution. But that they, you know, the adolescent years were no time for people to be in school, to be sitting and learning with their minds.
I would say they should be learning with their minds, but I should...
I mean in a school setting.
Yeah. I can agree with that approach, actually. But quite in the daylight out of some people.
Well, it would mean that instead of teachers, it would probably demand that there would be other kinds of people dealing with teens. That is, there wouldn't be the people who feel comfortable in a classroom with so many desks and so many students, but people who actually can deal with, adolescents in a real working situation. Probably the most threatening thing would be to the actual teaching profession.
Yeah. From one point of view, this is a good time to try and attempt that at the high school level, particularly because hard to raise money now for buildings.
Right.
And you can make tremendous savings on buildings.
Right. And there's so much other work that needs to be done in the community that you cannot pay adults to do. There's not enough money to pay them, or enough money to pay to richer adults. So, we've talked about that. We used to talk about that quite a bit.
Harvey Scribner, when he was commissioner, asked me if I would write up a proposal for a secondary school from Vermont, so I did, and it incorporated some of that approach. I estimated, the crude estimate, that you could make a tremendous saving on buildings because you wouldn't need to have only about half as extensive buildings as they now have. My own guess is that in 25 years, that a lot of these buildings that have been built on university and college campuses as well as on high schools are going to be monuments, mausoleums, you know? They're there, and people are going to wish they'd never built them because they want more flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's something to do with education here.
you're still involved in education, even though you're no longer a college.
Yeah, I get in quite a lot of time educational activity one way or another. I'm on the board of the Stowe School, and they're talking about moving to a new campus. They have the land, but they've been questioning what they want for buildings, and whether they can afford them, and all that sort of thing, and how the program fits in. I'm on the board of Trinity College, and they're all the time talking about educational programs. A very committed group, I would say. Then I'm on the Scandinavian Seminar, and that's the program that takes American college students to ranges for them to go to the Scandinavian countries to live and study in the Scandinavian folk schools. And then a tremendous amount I get involved in is through this Education Advisory Council. It's a very interesting group to be with. There are some teachers in it, and administrators, and some non-school people in it. And that's how I've gotten to know much more about public schools than I've been knowing for quite a while. Then I've also worked with candidates for the doctor's degree, three of them in Union Graduate School, and I'm working for one now at a place called Walden University, which is based in Florida. It's really works on the same principles as Union Graduate School does. Again, the ADP arrangement, basically. And I worked in one school in the college graduate program. Many of Herb Schnitzer. He's the head of Lewis Waters School over in New York State, which is a Summer Hill type school. He did a very interesting study on student rights in America. So by that method, I've willy-nilly been sort of forced into thinking about education. Then I've been on the Marshfield Bicentennial Committee on a lot of education like that too.
You want to talk about that too? I've got to eat a banana because I'm getting, how do you feel?
Why?
I'm getting
fine. Would you like some lunch? I'll make some lunch if you will eat some.
Yeah, okay.
And just kept on whenever all the 5 years I was daughter, that we were involved in making the thing go, trying to make it go, and then developing new approaches, finding the means to carry them on, taking a look at what we've done. I think we were reflective of several of us in a way about what we were doing at the college. Probably more than most institutions in that regard. That's one reason we had Chickering there, was to help us really look at what we were doing at the institution. Before him, we had a fellow named Don Leverage, who was not nearly as good at that sort of business, actually. And as a matter of fact, we got started on the winter conferences on education because we invited Dr. Kilpatrick and Tom Sperlich and one or two other persons, that's Paul Sperlich, becomes the board, to come up during the non-resident term and meet with the faculty and carry on a conversation with us about what we had been doing. So at the end, even the first semester, we wanted a reflective consideration of what we've been doing. And that's what started us on having what we came to call a conference on current education issues. Because these two outsiders who were there then found it a worthwhile enterprise and was for us. So from then on, instead of focusing on Goddard for these conferences, we just discussed really current educational issues. It's one of those serendipitous things that happened to me.
How has Goddard changed the immediate environment of this particular area?
Well, it's extremely difficult to sort it out because of other changes that occurred. If the college were to suddenly pull out, I think there would be for a while at least a considerable void in the community. I think a number of persons moved to the community because it was a college area, not because of Goddard per se, but because it was a college. That's the reason Hiram Hunt came. He came because it was Goddard. He got to know about Goddard through John Paul, and John was traveling in Iowa for the college of curriculum missions. And so Hiram, who had the first wife, I think it was, had come from Vermont, decided he'd like to settle in Vermont and retire. So that's when he chose the place he did. Yeah. But I would think that most persons who came did not come to this kind of college it is. On the other hand, from the very beginning of the very first year, we carried on a series of conversations, conferences, discussions with people in this immediate area. We talked a great deal about community development, for example, in one kind or another. And we got the different towns, officials of different towns, to come in and take a look at their town with the aid of people who came in from the state, various state departments. So that we had that kind of an impact, actually. It was because of the college that the Upper Nisbe Community School Association got going. That really grew out of a series of discussions that Evelyn Bates had, she's organized when she was working for her own degree at Goddard. She was on the staff. She came over as my secretary from Barry. She graduated from junior college and stayed on as secretary. So then when she came to work for her own degree, she was interested in adult education, and as part of her work, she organized these discussion groups. And out of those came the whole movement of what we called then the Community School Association. And then out of that came what was called the Upper Winooski Development Association, which embraced these six towns in Upper Winooski. We made a strong effort to bring the people of these six towns together to work cooperatively, attended to them, as you might expect, to keep somewhat separate from each other. And that lasted for quite a long time. It was in part the work of those two organizations that made it possible to bring about the bringing together of the Marshfield and Plainfield in the Plainfield district. It took some 25 years for it to happen, but it did happen for me. Originally, we had talked about having one high school that would serve the six towns, but we were not anticipating that any such terrific growth of East Montpelier was trained. See, East Montpelier had a boom, actually. But those activities had a good deal of effect, I think. The curious thing was that people came to those, saw them from one point of view as being somewhat apart from the college. The college was made up of these weird kids and some of the weird faculty. That was apparently suspected somehow. But nevertheless, they would come to these adult affairs, and here we were normal persons. Actually, it was curious thing. And then, of course, over the years, as the staff has increased, people have moved into these towns. Even up into Cabot, you see, there's several faculties up in that area. Some in Plainfield, some in East Montpelier, quite a few in Marshfield. And although I think they have not intermingled as much with the other people in the community, I think they've had an impact. Scott Newsom, for example, has had a good deal of impact in Marshfield because of his activities in the planning commission.
It sounds like you became a county agricultural agent, and in that you became a county educational agent, in a sense. Do you think, Tim, in some ways?
Well, yeah, I suppose that was one of our intentions, was that Goddard should be that kind of an institution. That's one reason I thought Jerry would make a good president, because I thought that Jerry was committed to Vermont. Well, I don't think he was so committed to Vermont as I assumed he was, because he didn't seem to be interested in that kind of relationship. But I always felt that it was a good idea for any college, but that was particularly for college like Darwin to do.
Well,
for one thing, for a variety of reasons. One is that I have a strong feeling for Vermont, and I think that colleges have the capacity for stimulating a certain amount of intellectual life. And Goddard was very much a Vermont institution. Although some people point of view that it was not, but in reality it was. And I had this kind of a notion that a college or some kind of education institution might do Vermont what the Danish Folk High School did for Denmark. Mm. Really transformed Denmark. Well, the Danish Folk High School started about the middle of the last century, and the idea came from kind of a maverick bishop, Bishop Rupert. And he proposed that there be this kind of school that would help rejuvenate the spirit of Denmark. And Denmark had become what was called the poorhouse of Europe. As you know, it has almost no natural resources. Mm. And over the years, it had lost the major part of its kingdom. It had once controlled Sweden, Norway, and what's now Northern Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And bit by bit, that had gone away. The people become desperately poor. And he felt that they should pay more attention to their own culture, develop some pride in their history, and their heritage, literature.
Mm-hmm.
And they created this school, which didn't come into full flowering, I'd say, until somewhere around the 70s. And it was set up for young persons, young people, adults, who had been working for many years. Of course, they left school at an early age in Denmark, and then they'd worked there for a long time. And the country was primarily agricultural anyway. So it was a six-month school in the winter, beginning in late fall, and running through the spring for young men. And then in the summer, they had the 3 months going for women. It was a residential school. The students tended to go to a different part of the country than where they actually lived, which didn't mean going very far.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that if you lived in Marshfield, you might go to school in Montpelier or Barrie, like I did.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I went, that was quite a ways off. Mm-hmm. Of course, in the 70s and earlier in Denmark, they had all been walking or traveling by horses. And the program was devoted to the literature, the history, the music, the life of Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
No serious study of agriculture per se, but out of it came a number of agricultural schools, which had a very special function,
mm-hmm.
actually. But there's a strong emphasis upon the spirit of Denmark, and they talked a great deal about the living word. Since they didn't use many books, it meant that the teachers had to teach by
mm-hmm.
talking to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
They did not use examinations. They did not give marks. There was no credit
mm-hmm.
for the students. And out of that came a tremendous number of the leaders of Denmark. A high percentage of people in the later years who were in the cabinet came out of the whole high school.
Mm-hmm.
And out of it came the cooperative movement. A whole series of developments. So that Denmark, in the course of literally one man's lifetime, was transformed from being the poorhouse of Europe to being one of the most prosperous countries and most progressive countries of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I knew about that. I learned about it, as a matter of fact, through a guy that I studied with at Columbia, who's a professor from the University of North Carolina, who had been to Denmark and done a study of it in a little book called Among the Danes.
Mm-hmm.
I got quite excited about the possibility of Danish Folk High School. And one of the reasons we set up these winter programs was to have something somewhat similar to the Danish Folk High School. We couldn't quite pull it off. We couldn't get Americans or Vermonters to spend even a month in residence, you know.
Why not?
Well, I think because it's the kind of society we are. We simply can't take time out. The Danes, being poor, could leave their farms, some of them they could, the young men, in the winter. Couldn't the summer because they had to keep them working.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently the women could be gone in the summers.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean in every home all of them got to be one or two persons. But Vermonters and Americans simply couldn't do it. So the nearest we ever came to it was what we call the farm school, which ran a week. But what would happen in that week was quite remarkable. We did a similar thing with labor, running a labor school, running the labor school in the summer and the farm school in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't talk very much about the problems of farmers or very much about the problems of labor. Per se, we talked about the literature, about history, and so on. We did have one course in labor that had to do with collective bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done some arbitrating in labor cases, so that I did that. But that's the news we came to it. And I think we didn't talk about the specific agricultural part, talk about it in general.
Yeah.
Well, the 1 week that they were, the young people were there, they were young farmers and their wives, or
mm-hmm.
I guess there may have been some single women, but I think by and large they were the young married women there. That 1 week seemed to give some of them just enough confidence themselves and courage so that they would go back home, and the next thing you know, you'd see evidence that they were now leaders in the community. They'd taken on this job or that job. And apparently, until that time, they had the possibility there, but never quite could achieve it.
Mm-hmm.
And this would give them enough, confidence in themselves to go ahead and do it, associating with other people that mm-hmm. sort. Well, that was the kind of thing that we set out to do with the college, and we had to modify what we set out to do because of the constraints that existed. But we did run a lot of the residential conferences. Almost every conference we ran was an overnight affair.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt this was terribly important. That people get away from their immediate pressure of their job or the home. And that was carried over into, you see, the Get Free program, and carried over into the adult degree program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you said that they had the confidence to become community leaders, is it important to be a community leader?
I didn't hear.
You had said that you gave some of these people confidence, courage to become community leaders.
Yeah.
And my question was, is it important to be a community leader?
I think so. For something, otherwise, we just drift.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like a shade for
mm-hmm. it? No, no. Which I may fall.
You've been without sunshine so much. Too bad. Just cut it out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know. Things don't happen unless somebody exercises leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need it desperately in all these communities.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been one of the leaders of this community?
Have I what?
Been one of the leaders of this community?
Not really.
Are there any leaders of this community?
Well, you know, I thought about that looking back earlier, and if there were, they were not conspicuous.
Yeah.
It would be very difficult to pick them out, actually.
Is that just the style of leadership in an area like this, do you think? Or?
Well, it may be. I don't know. I think in some ways, both Ronald and Belmont are leaders in the community. But I think if you ask them, they wouldn't think so.
Mm.
But they were very much involved in making the fire department what it is,
mm-hmm.
and in establishing relationships with other communities. Belmont Vic was involved in getting the planning commission going here in Marshfield. They do things of that sort, and it's a low-key operation, and there are other persons who do similar things, you know. Actually, Jane was the one who was responsible for getting senior citizens going, both in Marshfield and Plainfield. And probably most persons don't know that. But she just, she saw a possibility, and she was then working in the Plant State Planning Office and knew about grants that could be obtained, so we got a grant that came to Goddard to do a study of older citizens in these small communities. Out of that, got another grant to start with.